You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Hobb,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is Jennifer Robson. Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories Podcast today. You can find links to all of the shows at HankGarner.com. There's a handy sidebar where with links where you can subscribe to the show any way that you like to listen to podcasts. There's a link there. It's HankGarner.com. There's more than 500 shows. Dig in and find something that you would enjoy. I'd like to tell you about some sponsors today before we get started. Author Mary Buckham has a 3-book set. She's a USA Today bestseller. The Invisible Recruits, The Beginning, a 3-book set. Kindle edition is on sale now for $2.99. That's 3 books for $2.99. Join new IR agents Alec Nosiak and Kelly McAllister as they struggle to master their newfound preternatural abilities while being thrown into a dark world of danger and intrigue. Being an invisible recruit means learn hard lessons fast or die trying. Hidden from a world unaware of magic, Alex and Kelly are members of a group of operatives known as the Invisible Recruits, the only ones willing to stand between mankind and those powerful preternatural factions, seeking to change the balance of power and gain world domination. While battling for their lives, Alex and Kelly both must deal with dangerous creatures, mysterious paths, shape-shifting brothers, and more. What could possibly go wrong? Begin with the novella that started it all, Invisible Prison, to discover how Alex Nosiak first met the IR team. Then join Alex on her initial solo mission in Invisible Magic. Next, it's time to join teammate Kelly McAllister in a race to uncover secrets and stop evil growing in the heart of Africa. Mary writes stories full of grit and determination with plenty of action, but always with a sense of hope and a good dollop of romance. Get the 3-book set for only $2.99, Invisible Recruits, The Beginning, a 3-book set for Kindle. Also, I'd like to thank George Kramer. His new book, To Some, It's Just a Rose, is out now. Nancy Hemingway is a beautiful, wealthy heiress that has a penchant for attracting weirdos. When roses start mysteriously appearing at her doorstep, at work, and everywhere she turns, her friends begin disappearing. Nancy enlists her eccentric cousin Etna to help her figure out what's going on, only to discover that Etna isn't who she thought she was. Nothing is as it appears to be, and someone is targeting Nancy. Can she outsmart this lunatic and find her friends before it's too late? The new psychological thriller from George Kramer, To Some, It's Just a Rose. Thank you to J.R. Hanley and Chris Winder. Their new book, Breach Team, is out now. Survival means fighting through the unknown. Corporal John Harden is a decorated soldier living in the shadow of his father, a celebrated war hero. Determined to make his own way in the galaxy, John develops a reputation as a brawler serving aboard the USS Hughes. A rescue beacon brings John and his fellow legionnaires to a cargo ship thought lost 2 decades ago, and the heavily damaged alien vessel of an unknown species that took it down. With the brass demanding details and apparent survivors begging for aid, John's team boards the derelict ships, vowing to leave no man behind. On board, nightmares become reality as John and his team are separated and left behind, presumed to be killed in action. Assaulted on all sides by mysterious alien tech, John gets the chance to finally prove himself worth being his father's son, if he can survive the onslaught. The way home is inside, and John won't back down from the fight, though a determined enemy will make him pay for every inch. Breach Team is a non-stop action thrill ride with fast-paced warfare written by 2 veterans. Join the fight by getting your copy today. Breach Team by J.R. Hanley and Chris Winder. Thanks for listening. Now on to our interview. Well, thanks for joining me for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Jennifer Robson on the phone with me today, on the interview with me today. And we are talking about her brand new book, The Gown, but so much more. Jennifer has a number of books out, and she has a fantastic style that I'm really eager to dig into. If you follow me on Instagram, and you should, at Author Stories Podcast, you know that I got a copy of The Gown, maybe a month or two ago, Jennifer, and I posted a photo of it on there, and I've been digging into the book ever since, and it's a fantastic, fascinating read that is more than just the story of a gown. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, that's a good one. I think it would have been when I was back in primary school, one of the early grades. And, you know, I can't remember the book that I was reading at the time, but I think it might have been a book that belonged to my mom when she was little. And you know what? It was set in Roman Britain. And the name, though, has escaped me. And I wanted to rewrite the book. I loved it so much. I guess it was a case of early fan fiction. And I didn't get very far, a few pages, but that sparked the bug, I suppose. And I loved writing all through school. I wrote a lot of poetry, very, very bad poetry.
Didn't we all?
As we all did. In those, but then I left creative writing. I left fiction behind for a number of years. I became interested in history, and I pursued a graduate degree in history and wanted to teach it. And it was only, you know, years later when I had spent years as an editor and doing a lot of nonfiction writing for magazines and so forth, that I found myself at home with a newborn and a very busy 2.5-year-old. And was feeling that the work I was doing wasn't enough. And I had that feeling that the great Anne Lamott has called the tug on the sleeve of your heart. And I knew that I had stories that I wanted to tell. And that's when I started to write my first book, very, very slowly. As I say, I had two little ones at home and not a ton of time to devote to anything beyond being a mom. But I started very slowly writing the book that became my first novel, Somewhere in France. And from then, it's just been full steam ahead.
I love that allusion, the tug of the sleeve of your heart. Did she, was that in Bird by Bird?
Yes. Yeah.
I knew I'd heard it before, but I couldn't.
Yeah, I've certainly read and reread Bird by Bird. And I actually was a writer in residence at a library near Toronto recently. And I asked all the students there to read it because it doesn't tell you how to write, but it tells you how to be a writer.
Yes.
And that all of the allure of having a book published and becoming a best-selling author and all of those things, those things don't matter. And they're in fact not something you can think about when you start writing. All you can think about, all you can let yourself think about is the story you want to tell and what telling that story will do to you as a person, how it will change you. And she talks very movingly of how it in her, in terms of how it has affected her, but other writers she knows, it makes you more observant. You start to go around the world with your writer's eyes open and your ears open for the stories that surround you. I often tell people, be careful of what you say around me, because everything I see and hear and experience is all material that gets lodged inside my brain, and I'm never sure when little bits and pieces will come out and make their way into my story. Certainly never, you know, I would never repeat a story that's intensely personal to someone or use someone's name, but there are all these little elements that add up in the way people talk to one another. Who hasn't sat in a restaurant and had the couple at the table next to you be more interesting than your own conversation? And sometimes it's so hard not to listen. I try very hard not to, but especially when somebody's having an argument, I mean, that's, you can really learn a lot about the people that way and about, you know, the human heart, really. So I feel, that when I listen to Anne Lamott and listen to her advice and let myself listen to that tug, I changed my life, which I become very used to the idea of not being very satisfied with the work I did and not finding it very compelling. And it was only once I listened to that call and started writing the stories that had been kind of piling up inside me, that I then discovered what it is to love what you do and to wake up every morning with this absolute pull to get to the computer, to get to a notebook, and keep writing.
Well, what a great distinction it is to differentiate between how to write and how to be a writer. Mm-hmm. There are so many books on the craft and people's experience with the craft. Mm-hmm. You know, one book that people quote and cite over and over and over again is Stephen King's On Writing. Yeah. And what a fantastic book it is. But he has some very strong opinions about the way he pursues the craft. And some people don't see eye to eye with that. He says always avoid adverbs, and Neil Gaiman mm-hmm. would say sprinkle adverbs, loosely and proficiently. And
I don't think that their advice cancels each other out. I think right. adverbs are to be used judiciously.
Sure.
In that it's very easy to get carried away, and adverbs can overwhelm prose if you're not careful.
Right.
I wouldn't go so far as Mr. King is to say, never use them. And certainly if you read his books, there are adverbs there.
Sure.
But it's, and craft is one of these things that you can read a lot about it. And I think sometimes there's a tipping point where if you read too much about the craft and get too concerned about that, then it can overwhelm your own voice. You'll never sit down to write. I mean, the single best piece of writing advice I've ever heard, and a lot of writers offer it up, is the three words, which bum in chair.
Yes.
and Neil Gaiman has certainly talked about this, where really the only way you're going to become a writer is to actually apply yourself to the task of writing a story. And that sounds simple, but there are so many distractions, and especially with the wonderful world of social media, it's very easy to spend an entire morning on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram talking about writing, reading what others have to say about writing, setting challenges. Oh, I'm going to sit down and write 1,000 words. Who's with me? And then monitoring people's responses.
Instead of doing what you challenge people.
Instead of doing it. And so I find what I, the time that I'm most, how should I put it, that I get the kind of the best results in terms of sitting down, applying myself and seeing the words flow is when everything is turned off, except the computer. I type much faster than I can write things by hand. And so I turn everything off and I just let the words come. And a lot of the time they aren't very good words. And I go back later and think, oh gosh, what was I thinking? But in the best moments, the words come and you're pulling them from somewhere in yourself that you really have no real awareness of where it's coming from. And those are the moments I live for as a writer, when I can go back the next day. And one small piece of writing advice I would have is do edit yourself, but don't do it right away. you won't have the perspective. Give your thoughts and words a day or so to just sit before you go back and start tinkering with what you've written.
Well, but, and another great piece of advice that Anne Lamott gives us is to give yourself the permission to write that
the terrible
first draft. Yeah, we'll edit Anne just a little bit.
We won't use the exact word, yeah. But it's true. And that's where I struggle, because I am fundamentally an editor. Well, writer first, editor second, but the editor in me is still strong and is very loud at times. And so for me to sit down and hammer out a first draft is absolute agony. And I'm slow. I'm not one of these people who can write 5,000 words a day without really collapsing. And it's also the case that the work I do, you know, I write in kind of layers, I suppose. I write I suppose some people would call a first draft, but I really think of as just an outline, and an outline that I add layer upon layer to, because the history is woven in, and I can't write a scene about anything really set in the past unless I know the details to bring it to life, unless I have really the scenery in place and I can close my eyes and envision exactly what everything would look like, sound like, smell like. And so the story's there, but everything is interwoven with the history, and that takes time. So it's, you know, as much as I'd love to be able to hammer out a book quickly, and there are many writers who write quickly and well, but I'm not one of them, unfortunately. The single best advice I have for people is just to put your bum in the chair and to write. And you know, a dear friend of mine, also a writer called Karma Brown, she's been on the show, and she's one of my dearest friends, and I respect her so much. And she gets up at 5 and writes. And the clarity that she's able to bring to her work by setting that time aside for herself early in the morning is amazing. And that's how she manages to stay on her top of her deadlines and to really have a life that is very rich and full and not always be running around frantically chasing deadlines. She has the discipline to get up every morning and do that. And I do not have the discipline to do that every day. But when I, you know, am good about getting to bed early and so on, I find I can get up and the peace and quiet you get at that time of day is extraordinary. So if you can get yourself up early, I always say to people, even if you can just give yourself 15 minutes, half an hour before the day starts and the busyness begins, I do recommend that. It's amazing the words that'll come out of you when you have that stillness surrounding you.
I just love how everyone has these completely different ways of being creative and when the words flow for them and what the habits they form, and everyone's story is so different, but we can all take the same nuggets away, is that no matter you know what your schedule is like and when is best for you, if you don't sit in the chair and put your hands on the keyboard, it's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's go back for just a minute. You talked about that first experience with writing kind of fan fiction from the book that you got from your mother. It sounds like that you have been an historical fiction lover from the very beginning.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny because my dad, he's retired now, but he was a history professor for many, many years, and people rightly assume that the bug for history I got from him, and I did, and I have such high respect for him as a teacher and as a someone who has just such an interesting perspective in terms of writing and thinking about the First World War and the Second World War specifically. Those were his areas of interest, and it's no, it's certainly not a, you know, a surprise to me that those are my areas of interest as well. But my mom, who was a lawyer by profession and later a judge, loved historical fiction, loved it. And she died when I was only 21, but I had this moment not so long ago when I was on a panel with the great Margaret George, and having just, I just had this moment where I thought of how excited my mom would have been to see me sitting next to this just towering figure in the world of historical fiction, who also happens to be a delightful, lovely, warm person. But my mom left her books, and I got, you know, I had an interest in historical fiction as a reader very early, because those are the books that were lying around the house. And, you know, and I think some of what informs my work as a writer comes from some of those earlier reading experiences, in terms of, I really want to have a richness of setting that that will transport people. And it's a hard balance to get right, in that even the best writers, we all struggle with, I shouldn't say we, even the best writers struggle, and I as a writer also do, with not throwing the info dump at readers. No one really wants to get a big, long diatribe about, you know, the transportation system in Britain in the 1920s, for example. I could certainly talk about it, but I don't think anyone wants to read about it. But I also don't, so you know, you have to avoid the info dump, but you also have to avoid the wallpaper effect of where you've done the bare minimum. And,
right,
you know, and we've all read books that are like that, where it doesn't matter how great the story is or the characterization is, if the setting feels thin, in the sense of people are wearing vaguely old-timey clothes, and the buildings seem kind of old-timey, and nobody's driving a car or looking at a cell phone. But apart from that, you could really set it in any decade of the past century. That doesn't work for me as a reader. I want to feel transported. I want those little details. So it's about as my wonderful editor at HarperCollins says, it's layering in the details. And sometimes, you know, I have to pull back on the details. And sometimes she'll say to me, no, I want more. I really want to know what they ate at this meal. Could you just give me just a few words so I know what it is that they're eating, or what the building looks like, or the room they're sitting in? And then, of course, I get the fun moments where I'm allowed to go back and dig into my sources again and figure out, what were they eating? What would that meal have been? And how much would it have cost? And to get the details that will capture a reader's imagination, I think, because the detail is just different enough from their own known experience that it catches their eye. So it's a struggle sometimes to get that balance right. Certainly in my first drafts, my first messy, terrible drafts, that Anne Lamott recommends, I do not get the balance right. Typically it's a case of tons and tons of info dumping.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is, in that first draft, do you allow yourself to add in all the gory details that may not make it to another draft, but just, does that allow you to feel like you've gotten all the detail out, and then the editing is where that gets trimmed down?
Exactly. Yeah. Now there are cases too, where I'll know that I need to add in some details, but what I'm more interested in at that stage of the writing is capturing the voices of the characters I'm writing about, in dialogue, but also their internal thoughts. And so I'll focus on that and then remind myself, you have to go back later and fill in the details about how much the train ticket cost or what kind of shoes my heroine would be wearing. Little things that, and, you know, sometimes on second reflection, I say to myself, no, I don't need that detail. That's just going to, that people are going to trip over it, and it'll pull them out of the, what I hope is kind of the reverie that, that they can fall into as they're reading. So it's funny, I often use, and I recommend this to other writers, because if you're in the flow, if you've hit that groove and you're right, you're typing away or writing away and the words are coming to you, don't feel that you need to stop and go back to your reference books or your notes to find the detail that's missing from your brain that you want to put down. Just put in two letters, TK, and keep writing. Because the great thing about TK, which, you know, is a proofreader's mark for more or less to check. But the great thing about TK is in the English language, those two letters don't appear together anywhere else. And so if you then have to go back and do a search, you'll find all the TKs, they'll pop up. And so I often do that. I'll be writing and my characters are talking to each other and I don't want to break the flow of that. I can hear their voices in my head. But I won't know the little detail that I need to ground it in the story. So I'll just write down TK, keep going. And then, you know, later that day or a few days later, I'll go back and think, oh, I have to chase down that detail. And then I'll search, I'll find the TK, and then I'll know what it is that I have to chase down. And you know, most people who write historical fiction like me, we have I'm looking at it right now, actually. It's this long shelf adjacent to my desk that has it, that's the reference books, you know, the dictionaries of costume and military dress and maps of the First World War. There's one that has details of historic houses and those are the places that I can turn to find details. And of course the wonderful world of the interwebs has certainly transformed my life as an historian. You know, when I look back to how long it took me to research my doctorate when I was at Oxford, which would be coming up 26 years ago when I started, I had to look everything up by hand, effectively. I had to go to the Bodleian and search through, bound volumes that were the indices to the holdings, and then read through everything page by page and write down notes by hand and then collate that into the research. And I spent almost a year going to the big newspaper library in the north of London. Excuse me. And going through microfilm and ruining my eyesight in the process. And now that newspaper library doesn't exist anymore. They've closed it because every page of newspaper dating back to the early 18th century that it holds has been digitized. And along with being digitized, it's been indexed. And so it's searchable. So now if I need to find something from the National Newspaper Library in the UK, I just go online and I type in what I need, what I'm looking for. And there it is. And I try not to think of how much time that would have saved me if I'd been doing. I probably, my best guess is that I could have lopped off about 18 months over the course of the 5 years it took me to do my doctorate.
Wow. That's incredible when you think about it.
Yeah. But, you know, I live in England.
Well, yeah.
In England and go to the Bodleian most days and live in Oxford. And that was a privilege and a real honor. So I'm not whining about that, but I do sometimes think, oh gosh. And I mean, how fortunate I am now to be doing, now that I'm doing this work, to have these resources at my disposal.
Right.
I do feel very, very lucky to in that sense, to be living in a time where, you know, information. It's much more democratic in terms of the access to information that we have. And that's not without its pitfalls, of course. But, you know, you don't have to be wealthy now to research a novel properly. You know, in the past, you'd have to save up money and go to England and sit in the archives. And not everybody had the wherewithal to do that. I certainly didn't when I first started writing. I couldn't justify a trip overseas. You know, now if you're writing, you just need a good computer connection. And you don't even, if you don't have the money to pay for access to sites that are behind paywalls, if you belong to a good library system, a public library system, most of them do have access. And it's a case of just going to the library. So in that sense, I think things have changed very much for the better since I was an undergraduate and graduate student many, many years ago.
Sure. Well, and can you really ever say that time spent in a musty old library was time wasted?
It's, you know, I remember when I first read A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness, which is just a fantastic book. And you know, a lot of your listeners will be familiar with it.
She was on the show last month.
Well, and she is just amazing.
Fantastic.
And not only I love her characters, but the scenes where they are in the Bodleian and they're researching things. Now I know that makes me a complete history nerd for loving that, but I've read and reread those passages so many times. I find them so fascinating. And I remember years ago having a moment, I think when I was at Oxford, and again, they've digitized their holdings to a certain degree so that, you know, you don't consult, you don't search for volumes using these big, really they were large kind of leather bound volumes that you would pull out. And so if the book you thought you were looking for would start with M, then you pull out one of the many volumes that began with M and you'd open it. And they were larger than folio size books. The holdings were indexed on little pieces of paper that had been glued into these larger books. And quite often the glue would fail. And so when I'd open the book or the big index, little bits of paper would fly out. And, you know, and then, of course, you'd gather it up carefully and take it back to one of the librarians and say, oh, the glue failed, and they'd glue it back together. But I often thought, well, what happens if one of those little slips of paper falls under one of the bookcases? Is that book lost?
Right.
How will anyone ever find it? And, of course, Deborah Harkness, that's one of the turning points in the plot is that of A Discovery of Witches, it's what happens if a book is lost. Right. In the sense that, or lost/hidden. So she definitely, you know, obviously had that idea and went with it. And it just was a stray idea, but someone had the smarts to run with that. And all credit to her.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the new book for just a minute here, Jennifer. We have recently, in the last few years, there's been a Netflix series, The Crown, which brings a lot of us. I'm in my mid 40s, and Queen Elizabeth has been the Queen of England my entire life. But I have known very little about the early days of her reign, and you know, I know the history bullet points, you know, that got us to where we are. Mm-hmm. And this show has been absolutely fascinating to me and my family. We've all watched it together and really enjoyed it. But there's so many details that are brought out that I just never, you know, had the opportunity to think about. Mm-hmm. And your book takes this time period and you not only add some some detail there that I never thought to think about. But then you tie that with a very personal connection with the characters. Where'd the idea for this book come from? And I think some people might be might not really appreciate the depth of history in this book because they might just dismiss it. Oh, this is a book about, you know, a wedding dress. And it's just so much more than that. So where'd the book come from and what was your motivation for writing it?
Well, it started with most of my book, the books that I've written, they begin with a conversation between me and my editor and quite often my literary agent, who is a wonderful, wonderful woman. And so smart and full of wonderful ideas herself. She'll be part of that conversation. And we were actually in San Diego. I'd been at a writer's conference there and we were having lunch, and I will admit that I had at least a glass of wine, which sometimes just a small amount of wine can be very conducive to these conversations. And we were talking about the next book. I was just finishing off work on the previous book to The Gown, which was Goodnight from London, and they wanted to know what I would do next. And I'd had actually an idea that again, I wasn't sure of, and in fact, fell by the wayside. And so we started, you know, it's brainstorming, really. And so we all knew that the next book I did should probably take place in the post-war period. In my case, I like writing about the years that follow a war, because I think what happens after the war is almost as interesting as what happens during a war.
Well, that's where all the cultural fallout starts to show.
Yeah, and people quite often are struggling. And in Britain in particular, I mean, we have this tendency, and I'm guilty of it as well, of skating over those post-war years and thinking – so that you go straight from VE Day or in 1945 to the 1950s, and everything's in Technicolor, and you know, the economy is booming, and everyone's starting to drive these big cars, and you know, there are TV shows, and life is kind of just nothing but really bounty as we look to it from our perspective now. And that is to a degree more or less but reflective of what things were like in the United States, for example, from the, say, the early to mid 50s onwards. But in Britain, things were still pretty terrible. And the post-war period was such a difficult period in Britain, not only because of the terrible losses that people had suffered personally, but also, you know, the country was crumbling. The economy was had flattened. The infrastructure of the country had been very much affected, and certainly everywhere you looked, there were bombed out sites, and not enough housing for people, and there were widespread food shortages and fuel shortages, and then the winter of 1946-47 was desperately cold. It was, you know, kind of a Canadian style winter, but in Britain, where very few people had anything like central heating or indeed any kind of insulation in their homes. And so it was this kind of very dour, gray, unsettled time for people. The problem is it's a very interesting period to think about, but maybe even to write about, but to read about it, it can be a bit of a slog, right? And kind of like having a big bowl of breakfast cereal that's made out of nothing but bran. I mean, you know, it's good for you and it's a worthy thing to learn about, but is it entertaining? And I was concerned it wouldn't be.
Well, and like a bowl of bran, we don't necessarily like our fiction in the form of something we have to choke down.
Yeah. Like, who wants to? And that's called a book that people are going to put down after 10 pages, and right, myself included. So how do you leaven that? And so I thought, well, I have to find something I can pin the book to that isn't necessarily this choking, gray, depressing time. And that's when it hit me that there was one thing that happened in 1947 that was very much a bright spot in all the gloom, and it was the wedding of Princess Elizabeth. And because not only was the royal family beloved by the British people, and indeed by many people around the world, but people, I mean, we all, it's very hard to resist the allure of a wedding, in the sense that two young people who appeared to be very much in love. And I mean, look at them now, 71 years later, and still going strong. And she was beautiful. You know, now that the Queen's in her 90s, and I must say still a very lovely person, but she was, at 21, she was very, very beautiful. And Prince Philip was certainly just like had those matinee idol good looks. And the two of them together, you know, in the love story, it was a very potent mix. And then just the desire for something to celebrate, I think, was very strong among people in Britain and elsewhere. And so I thought, well, okay, I can pin my story to the story of the royal wedding. I knew I didn't want to write about the royal family themselves. And this isn't because I think they're uninteresting. I mean, look at The Crown. It was more the case that as a writer, I feel I need to be able to get inside kind of the mind, the spirit of the people I'm writing about. I need to know something of their interior life. And one of the things about the Queen that is very distinctive is that we really do not know anything of her interior life. We can speculate, many people do, and certainly they do in The Crown. I personally didn't feel comfortable doing that. To a certain degree, that's me as a Canadian. You know, the Queen is our head of state in Canada, as she is in Britain. But it also, it just felt intrusive to me. And I just didn't feel I'd be able to do justice to it, to a story if she were the narrator, effectively. So I thought, well, who else can tell this story? And in the course of my conversation with my editor and literary agent, we were talking about the fact that, you know, when William and Kate were married, for example, and her gown was so beautiful, but we never heard the stories of the women who made it. We know that Sarah Burton at Alexander McQueen was the designer, but we don't know who actually you know, made the dress, created the dress, who stitched it. And I think, in all fairness, one of the reasons we don't hear the stories of the women who worked at McQueen or more recently making the Duchess of Sussex's dress at Givenchy, it's because of privacy reasons. Certainly, no, you know, it wouldn't be right for their names to be made public and then they would be hounded by the press and so on. So I understand that, but I'm still curious. I would love to interview one of those women and find out what it's like, you know, creating that beautiful embroidery on Meghan's veil, which I actually saw a couple of days ago when I was in England. I went to Windsor Castle and I got to see it up close, and it is exquisite. So I thought, well, let's take this back to 1947. Who were the women who made the gown? And what then further stoked my curiosity was the fact that no one at the time interviewed any of them. In fact, I was unable to uncover really the names of any of them, a few, but you know, the records that Hartnell are held privately. He did speak of the royal wedding in his memoirs, but only a few people are named. And so it was this mystery to me. Who were these women and what were their stories? And so that led me you know, in interesting directions, because there were very few people who could answer that question for me. And although I approached the people at the Royal Collection who take care of the gown itself, the wedding gown, which I saw on display and it has been preserved very carefully, they didn't have any answers either. And there are moments where I thought, oh, can I write this book? Will I be able to find out enough about these women to tell their story, or even to tell a fictionalized version in a way that has enough detail that people will accept the story and find it compelling? So the one of the first kind of unusual avenues it took me was took me back to Britain to a renowned hand embroidery studio, where to this day they it was called Handed Lock, and it was founded, I think, in 1767, I believe. I may be a little wrong on that date, but it's certainly been around for several centuries. And they do this very, very fine embroidery, not only for couturier, but also for military uniforms, ecclesiastical uniforms, and the royal family. So they do, when a new Knight of the Garter is named, for example, they will embroider the robes that the knight or lady of the garter will wear. And so I went to them and asked if someone there could teach me or show me how the embroidery was done on Princess Elizabeth's wedding gown, because it was the gown itself, the design, the silhouette, as it were, is pretty familiar to anybody who's seen wedding pictures of relatives from the 40s or 50s. It was the embroidery that really set it apart. It just very, very incredibly ornate embroidery. Of a standard that is so high that very few people alive are able to do such fine work. So I knew I wouldn't be able to actually do anything to that level, but I wanted to learn what it was like to sit at a chair and spend a day or many days or many years, in fact, with an embroidery frame. You know, the fabric is stretched on a wooden frame when it's being embroidered. What it was like to sit in a chair at that frame all day and to empty your mind of everything else and to just focus on the work. And so I went to Hand and Lock and worked with a wonderful embroiderer called Juliette Ferry, who's a young French woman and incredibly talented. And I recreated with a lot of help from her just a single small motif from Princess Elizabeth's wedding dress. And it took me 10 hours, at the end of which my eyes were burning and my neck was killing me. And I must have stabbed myself hundreds of times with the fingers with those needles. But it gave me an insight into what it was like to be an embroiderer at Norman Hartnell's studio in 1947.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you didn't want to write the book from the perspective of the queen, and for a number of reasons that I completely understand and agree with, but by stepping out and getting the perspective of the people working with her and around her for this very special project, did that allow you to get a narrator's view that allowed you to take in more of the effect of the time, mm-hmm. The post-war effect, this joyous occasion that rallied so many people? Did that allow you to step back and get the story that you never could have if you told it from the Queen's perspective?
I think so. And then because the characters I created, so my two central characters are Anne, who's an English woman who has worked at Norman Hartnell since she's 14. So she came to Norman Hartnell as an apprentice, and her whole working life has been at Hartnell, and she's completely devoted to him and to Miss Dooley, who's the head embroiderer at the at the design house, and really working for Hartnell is her life. And so she comes to it from the perspective of someone who is entirely devoted to the royal family, and is very aware of the honor that has been placed in her hands of working on the gown. And then I contrast that with the experiences of Miriam, who is a French woman, a little bit younger than Anne, who has had a very difficult time during the war and decides to leave France at the beginning of the book and come to England. And she finds work at Hartnell. And she herself is a very talented embroiderer who's been trained in the they have these workshops where only embroidery is done. And she's worked on gowns for Christian Dior. And so, but because she's an outsider, because she's French and with obviously no royal family, she's a little dubious. I mean, who are these royal people that everyone's so excited about? And how is it that everyone loves them so much? She doesn't really get it at the beginning. And I think she remains somewhat dubious throughout. But I needed that as a contrast so that it's not just one long rah, rah, rah royal family. Because there were people who were a little iffy on whether there should be a big royal wedding so soon after the war and when everyone was really struggling. And I actually, when I started my research, I was prepared to find that there was a lot of dissent, that a lot of people were not keen on the idea of a royal wedding and spending public funds on something that was effectively a private, a private occasion. Although when you're the heir to the throne, it's your personal occasions are never private.
Right.
I mean, I think we all know that Harry would have loved to have had a very small wedding, but that wasn't an option for him, and so hence the large royal wedding. So I was expecting to see a lot of dissent, and what I found was there was some dissent, and there are certainly people who were rolling their eyes a little bit, but most people, even people who weren't necessarily rah-rah royal enthusiasts, most people were actually behind the idea of a what you'd think of as a proper wedding for Princess Elizabeth, which meant no cutting corners. It had to be at Westminster Abbey. She had to have a beautiful gown. There was some concern, which I saw in newspaper articles and people's accounts of the time. There was some concern that because of rationing restrictions, clothes were still heavily rationed, that she would not be allowed to have a proper wedding dress. And to the degree people were so concerned, they started sending in their clothing coupons to her, which she was unable to, she wouldn't have accepted in any event, but she could not legally accept because it was illegal to give your clothing coupons to someone else. And so everyone who sent her coupons received them back with a thank you note from, I guess, a lady in waiting. And instead, a special allotment of extra coupons was made in Parliament for the princess to have. Because people were thinking, well, if she can't have a wedding dress, what is she going to do? And will she get married in her ATS uniform? She'd been in the auxiliary services during the war. So there was a real push for her to have a proper wedding. And they certainly it was very modest in terms of public decorations. And even within the Abbey, there were very few flowers. The wedding breakfast was very modest, for example, and was the food that was served was fell within the rules in terms of what rationed food and so on. The royal family was very good the king in particular was a stickler for obeying those rules. And if the people could only have certain things, then they conformed to that as well. There's in fact, as an aside, there's a very funny story that Eleanor Roosevelt wrote about staying at Buckingham Palace during the war, and how the king showed her around the rooms where she was staying, and he showed her the line that was painted inside her bathtub and asked that she please not have any more hot water than it could only come up to the line. And the line was only about 2 inches from the bottom of the bathtub, which is a very modest bath indeed. And then, you know, when they ate their dinner that night, it was on the, you know, on gold plates, but it was rationed food. So they certainly weren't eating, you know, luxurious food while everybody else was making do with Spam. They were eating the same thing with, I think, you know, they had access to their kitchen gardens and so on. So, but it, so to go back, there really was this need for a royal wedding. And so what I wanted to look at was, well, what was it like to be simultaneously a part of it, as Anne and Miriam were, but also obviously not a part of it. They weren't really, you know, they weren't part of the wedding party and so on. They weren't participating in it, but they were involved. They offered that essential behind the scenes look that I was so keen to find out what was it and what is it like to be a part of a royal wedding and yet not part of it. Because wouldn't any of us have wanted to be a fly in the wall behind the scenes at any of the recent royal weddings? That would be so fascinating.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The book is a fascinating read, Jennifer, and I feel like we could talk all day, but we're out of time. There's also a modern day component to the book that I think people are going to really, it really just draws you into the story.
Thank you.
And it's a really, makes for it to be a more personal story. So I highly recommend everybody get a copy of The Gown. If you love historical fiction, you're absolutely going to fall in love with this book. Ernie Howard has a new book up for pre-order. It's called Melody 8. My mother used to sing to me when I was scared at night. She would lay beside me and I would place my head on her chest, hearing the song through the vibration of her body. I loved my mother's voice right up to the day she was put to death because of it. If you're a lover of post-apocalyptic stories, you need to get ready for a new twist on the genre. We must change the vibration, or the frequency will forever change us. Melody 8. Pre-order it now from Ernie Howard. Soulbreaker by Clara Coulson is free right now. There's a dangerous monster loose on the streets of Aurora, Michigan, and Detective Cal Kinsey is determined to stop it, or die trying. 2 years ago, Cal Kinsey was an up-and-coming cop in the Aurora Police Department. But during a fateful nighttime stakeout in search of a prolific killer, Cal witnessed the darkest corner of his dreams come to life. A rogue vampire slaughtered his partner and introduced Cal to the supernatural world he never knew existed in the shadows. Soulbreaker is free now from Clara Coulson. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also by August Ansel, After the Pretty Pox, The Attic. A searing act of bioterrorism, a catastrophic plague they call the Pretty Pox. Most of the human race is dead, and for 2 years, Ari McInnes has been alone, riding out the aftermath of the disease. Hidden in the attic of her ruined home, Ari survives by wit and skill, ritual and habit. Convinced that humans are little more than a dangerous fluke of nature, she chooses solitude, even in matters of life and death. Ari's precarious world is upended when her youngest brother, a man she's never met, appears out of nowhere with a badly injured woman. Their presence in the attic draws the attention of a dark watcher in the woods, and Ari is soon forced to choose between the narrow ideas that have sustained her and a stubborn instinct to love and protect. In book one of August Ansel's captivating post-apocalyptic series, After the Pretty Pox, cast an unwavering eye on what it means to be human in a world where nature has the upper hand, and the only rules left to live by, for good or ill, are the ones written on our hearts. After the Pretty Pox, The Attic. There's a link to it in the show notes. Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. You can find archives of all of the shows at hankgarner.com, and when you're there, please subscribe. Up next is an audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh, she'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whirls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.